Active History is pleased to present a recording of Mark McGowan's talk, Uncomfortable Pews, British North America's Religious Groups Ponder Confederation. The talk was delivered as part of the Other 60s, a decade that shaped Canada and the world, a symposium hosted by the Department of History at the University of Toronto. The talk was delivered on April 22nd, 2017.
I'm going to do something uncharacteristic of me, too. I'm going to read large sections of this, and you'll understand why. I normally will just speak to notes, but that will come later. At first glance, it appears that Pierre Burton's comments from his infamous book, The Comfortable Pew, published in 1965, that the voice of Christian churches of his decade were weak, tardy, equivocal, and irrelevant, may have applied to the same ecclesial bodies a century before. In 1968, in one of the only two existing scholarly discussions focused on the role of the Christian churches and the Confederation movement, John Webster Grant, the undisputed dean of Canadian church history, pronounced, and I quote, "The main decisions were taken in legislatures and conference chambers while the people looked on rather apathetically. Outwardly, at least, religious considerations played a lesser role in the birth of Canada than they had in the struggle for American independence. Synods and conferences of churches had virtually nothing to say about Confederation. Anglican bishops largely ignored it in their charges. Its consummation was not marked by church services throughout the nation, although the Evangelical Alliance sponsored a limited service of thanksgiving in Toronto," end quote. Similarly, in the other article, when commenting on the role of the Roman Catholic Church in the consummation of the Confederation Agreement, Walter Ullman wrote of an apparent lack of interest of the bishops in the very transfer of powers. "The bishops did not speak with their customary authority," end quote. Aside from Ullman and Grant, who were writing in search of a story of church and state engagement to mark Canada's centennial celebrations, there has been practically no in-depth scholarly study of the engagement between churches and the makers of Confederation. Now, one might look to Franklin J. Wilson's master's thesis titled Roman Catholics and the Confederation Movement for one of the few comprehensive attempts to understand how Catholics engage with the Fathers of Confederation. Now, the fact that the thesis was completed at Queen's University in 1936 and it was not borrowed until 1956 signals the level of interest in the scholarly community of the question at hand. And as if adding his own nail to my coffin, in 1972, John Sargent Moyer, the other scion of Canadian religious history, wrote, quote, "Officially, the churches had almost nothing to say about Confederation," a claim he slightly qualified 15 years later when he penned that, quote, "Without exception, the churches were favorable to the idea of Confederation, but the religious press seldom commented on the process," end quote. Yes, even my thesis supervisor. So before concluding that this paper is McGowan's version of a Seinfeld moment, a paper about nothing at all, perhaps we should revisit the question, but using new eyes and new ways of understanding. Canadian historiography has changed, as have the questions posed by historians of religion in the 50 years that have elapsed between our time and that of Grant and Ullman. Developments in social, economic, women's, Aboriginal, ethnic, and labor history have provided a much broader and rich canvas upon which the questions of politics and religion can be painted. Religious historians have also changed the ways in which they undertake research. So, and perhaps in light of how we research religion in Canada today, 50 years after Centennial Year, it may not have been that there was nothing there, but perhaps we were not asking the appropriate questions. In an article on the Catholic Church and minority rights published in 1989, Roberto Perrin suggested that the questions Ullman posed in trying to understand Bishop Ignace Bourget of Montreal in his response to Confederation were, and I quote, futile. Perrin intimates, and I agree with him, that Ullman had Ullman understood the nature of being a bishop in 19th century Canada, Ullman would have realized that he was approaching the question of Catholic engagement with Confederation from the wrong angle. And I'd like to follow up this idea in the time I have remaining. So for argument's sake, let's start with an examination of the role of the bishop within the Catholic Church in British North America in the early 19th century. Because of the hierarchical nature of the church at the time, the role of the bishop is critical to understanding the manner in which the institutional church engaged the public square and its civic and secular leaders. This is not to ignore or to gainsay the fact that laypersons, most notably Catholic editors and politicians, pronounced on issues in the civic arena, but it's the bishop's position that constituted the institutional position, and in the 19th century, this carried far more weight in positioning the church on a variety of issues in the world than it does in our own time. When politicians, business leaders, and others wanted to curry favor with the church, it was essential that they do so by engaging the bishops. So in early 19th century British North America, four characteristics may be identified as typical of the behavior of the Catholic bishop in his relationship with the state. First, since the conquest of 1763 and its subsequent treaties and constitutional acts, the Catholics in what was called the Old Province of Quebec had been accorded unprecedented rights to practice their faith in a Protestant empire. One result of the Quebec Act of 1774 was that Catholic bishops reciprocated with public professions of loyalty to the British Crown. Such loyalty was also mandated by Rome, which had cultivated a growing diplomatic rapprochement with the British government, and also was in accord with St. Paul's letter to the Romans, chapter 13, which demanded that Christians be loyal and submit to legitimate authority. Jean-Olivier Briand, the first bishop of Quebec after the conquest, included King George III when he sang the Te Deum. His successor, Joseph-Octave Plessis, supported the defense of Canada and the British crown during the War of 1812, and it goes on and on and on. Now, secondly, in the public square, Catholic bishops in all of the colonies were careful that their pronouncements and intercessions should come only on issues that directly affected the church and its faith and morals. And it's those teachings on Catholics. Episcopal interventions in the public square were generally restricted to three major areas of concern: marriage and the family, education, and public decency, and you can put in brackets there, censorship. On these issues, the historian will discover meaningful public discourse between bishops and civic leaders. One should not be inclined to see the Constitution as constitution-making as germane to the interests of the bishop, unless that constitution-making endangered the faith and morals of the bishop's flock. Thirdly, when bishops did want to intervene into the public debate, they often did so through the agency of friendly Catholic politicians. In the 1860s leading up to Confederation, the bishops looked to Thomas Darcy McGee, Georges-Étienne Cartier, and Hector-Louis Langevin as their eyes and ears in the constitutional debates. Finally, the bishops of this period were not united as a body. There were no conferences of Catholic bishops. No singular voice could speak for them all. They were individual religious leaders, often regionally focused, and independent voices responding to circumstances that were relevant to their own flocks. While the two archbishoprics, one in Quebec and one in Halifax, had administrative sovereignty over 9 suffragan dioceses and 5 suffragan dioceses, respectively, the ecclesiastical structure in no way ensured that bishops within the same region saw eye to eye on any issue. Quebec and Montreal had a history of squabbling over a variety of matters, and as we soon shall see, Irish bishops in Toronto and in Halifax had little to unite them other than the land of their birth and the common faith that they professed. Now, collectively, the Catholic bishops governed approximately 1.3 million British North Americans in the proposed federation, 25% of Nova Scotia, 33% of New Brunswick, 84% of Canada East, and 18% of Canada West. Thus, the presence and the position of the Catholic Church in the Confederated Territories was not insignificant. So, where do I go from here? There were essentially three uncomfortable pews that would be of concern to the bishops on the years leading up to Confederation. First, given the stormy creation of the United Province of Canada in 1841, and the sectarian and linguistic rancor that characterized the 1850s in that central province, bishops were concerned about the protection of the Catholic faith and French culture, particularly given the numeric strength of English-speaking Protestants in British North America. First pew. Second pew. Catholic prelates were concerned about the status of their state-supported denominational schools in any proposed federation. And the final uncomfortable pew was the question of loyalty, which long had been a means through which Catholics sought respectability in the Protestant colonies. In the context of the formation of a new dominion, Catholics of Irish birth and descent would be under increasing scrutiny because of emerging volatile nationalism outside of Canada. Public expressions of loyalty from Upper Canadian and Maritimes bishops would be shaped by their reactions to the activities of Irish nationalists in the United States, in Ireland, and even in British North America. And I'm sure David Wilson is going to wax about that quite eloquently later on this afternoon. Because these individuals were hell-bent on using physical force to win Irish freedom by holding Canada hostage. Fenianism cast a doubt on Catholic loyalty to the new Confederation, which prompted loud defenses from prelates, many of whom had not uttered public support for Confederation before 1866, while still holding support for Confederation prior to that time. So let me just speak to these three uncomfortable pews. The first, of course, affected more the French-Canadian bishops in Quebec. And given the fact that Cartier and the Parti Bleu had insisted upon a federation wherein individual provinces would hold such things as educational, health, and social service rights, what wasn't there for a Catholic bishop to like? Control of education by a Catholic majority in the assembly, control and assurance of new and emerging religious orders who are going to be serving in the hospitals and social services, were sufficient enough to keep Catholic bishops on the sidelines watching as this new idea, as Arthur Silver would say, of a nation took shape in Cartier's policy. There is an exception, and that is Louis-François Laflèche, okay, the vicar general of the Diocese of Trois-Rivières. He used his close political contacts with Cartier in the Bleu to acquire the documents, to read the documents, and then, not holding any illusions that the deal was perfect, regarded the proposed constitution as, and I quote in English, a platform of salvation from the sectarian and sectional bitterness inherent in the existing province of Canada. Ullman is essentially correct when he points out that there were a lack of public pronouncements by other French-Canadian bishops on the Confederation issue. In a practical sense, Bishop Thomas Cook of Trois-Rivières and Archbishop Pierre-Flavien Turgeon of Quebec were both gravely ill and were not closely engaged with anything, including politics, at that time. And I would agree with Ullman that Turgeon's coadjutor, Charles-François Baillargeon, was reluctant to assert himself on any major issue while his superior was still alive. Ullman's interpretation of Bourget's silence in Montreal is more perplexing. Bourget was complex in his approach to Confederation, and behaving like a bishop of his time was expected to. Bourget was not unaware of what was contained in the resolutions from the Quebec Conference, and behind the scenes, he struggled to defeat at least one of the provisions, the transfer of the power of divorce to the proposed federal government. For Bourget, this was a surrender, at least by Catholics, of a power over marriage to the federal House of Commons that would be dominated by les maudits protestants. While his correspondents argued that this would make divorce harder to get for Catholics, which should be pleasing to the shepherds of the faith, Bourget considered the Church's prohibitions on divorce in better hands if controlled by the Catholic-dominated provincial assembly. Since the Bleu politicians argued that the Quebec resolutions had to be voted on in bloc, Bourget's arguments fell on unwilling ears. Nevertheless, the flip side is that the new Code Civil of Quebec was being revised at the time, and Bourget did secure property and ownership rights for religious orders, which assured hospitals and social services in the province. Not at all unengaged. He was engaged. Now, the interesting thing is that why did he not say anything publicly? Bourget knew that making a public statement on the constitutional process was fraught with dangers for his office. Public endorsement of Confederation after 1865 would have placed him in public agreement with two Catholic politicians for whom he had little time. Georges-Étienne Cartier, a Montreal MP, was also the solicitor for the Sulpician Order, which had been a thorn in Bourget's side over the division of the parish of Notre-Dame in Montreal. And given the historic tensions between the Bishop of Montreal and the Sulpician Order, an endorsement of Cartier's plan was out of question. Secondly, another Montreal MP, Thomas Darcy McGee, had been part of resistance to Bourget when he attempted to divide St. Patrick's Parish, which would have destroyed the Irish numerical majority there. Bourget would not be seen as supporting the pro-Confederation McGee. On the opposite side, had Bourget publicly cast doubt on Confederation, he would have been seen as holding the same position as the Parti Rouge and its anti-clerical base. Such publicity perceived common interest between he and the politicians that actively supported his anathematized Institut Canadien. That was too scandalous for Bourget to imagine. So in the end, we can account for the French-Canadian bishops quite well by methodologically looking at their internal correspondence with politicians, not on public pronouncements. Second uncomfortable pew, and I'll just speak to that briefly, is of course the issue of separate schools, which were entrenched legally in Canada East and Canada West for the minorities there, Catholics in the West, Protestants in the East. In the Maritimes provinces, by gentlemen's agreement in the city of Halifax and its area, and all schools under the Act of 1858 in New Brunswick were public, but many had transformed themselves into denominational schools. Catholic bishops were particularly adamant about preserving these schools under the new constitutional agreement, so much so that Article 43 in the 72 resolutions of Quebec attempted to protect denominational schools, except for the Maritime provinces, in which case Archbishop Connolly of Halifax actually traveled to Westminster knowing that there would be no voice for English-speaking Catholics at that conference in 1866. He did it on his own dime. He had digs close to the parliamentarians who were meeting there to discuss it. He wined and dined them. The Langevin brothers report that he drank somewhere between 3 and 4 glasses of wine with dinner each night and brandy before bed and was a jovial host. In small part, he helped shape with those politicians Section 93 of the British North America Act, which would be security for denominational schools and essentially allowing the federal government powers of disallowance and remedial legislation should provincial majorities tread on the rights of minorities. He did not affect these for the Maritime provinces because essentially the politicians told him that it was beyond them at Westminster to change any of the arrangements that had been made prior to that point. He would have to go back to the province of Nova Scotia and effect change there. That was politically impractical, although Connolly did attempt through his friendship with Tupper. But separate schools was an area, an uncomfortable pew, full of splinters for bishops right across the country. Secure in what would become Quebec, not necessarily so secure for the Maritime provinces. A third uncomfortable pew is that of loyalty. And of course, as I pointed out before, one of the hallmarks of Catholic bishops to that point in the history of British North America had been their loyalty to the crown. In this particular case, loyalty was threatened by the Fenian Brotherhood, which had been founded simultaneously in the United States and in Ireland in 1858, with the promise to invade British North American colonies with demobilized troops from both Union and Confederate armies. This was probably the most uncomfortable pew for Bishops Lynch of Toronto, the other two Johns, John Farrell in Hamilton, John Horan in Kingston, Bishops Rogers in Chatham, New Brunswick, Bishop Sweeney in St. John, and Bishop McKinnon in Aarhuset, and Archbishop Connolly. But here, the Irish couldn't even agree among themselves as to what the position of the Irish were in the country. Lynch went public saying that Connolly was wrong, thinking that the Irish and British North America had a most favored state. They actually had a public correspondence and a private correspondence. One sent a 15-page letter, the other, when they did write letters, a 12-page letter back in refutation, agreeing to disagree. But the one thing that they did agree upon was that this revolutionary nationalism was not part of what made up Irish Catholic loyalty in both the provinces as they exist and would in Confederation. And in fact, because many pro-Confederates, according to Peter Toner, used loyalty as a litmus test, it was absolutely important that by 1866 the Catholic bishops did speak out. And that's why we see them speaking out at that point. The other uncomfortable pews essentially had been sanded and in some cases polished very nicely. This one remained quite thorny because indeed the Fenians did invade June 2nd, 1866 at Ridgeway. They actually did win and then retreated. There were several unsuccessful engagements elsewhere at Eccles Hill in Quebec, Capabello Island in New Brunswick, and even an attempt to hook up with Riel later on in Manitoba. So in retrospect, and I will now conclude, with the exception of the outspoken Connolly and the scholarly Lafleche, Catholic bishops of British North America behaved as one might expect a Catholic bishop to do within the colonial context of that time. They rarely strayed into public constitutional debates unless the faith and morality of their Catholic flock was threatened. With issues of marriage and the family, denominational schools, and public decency as prime issues of concern for them in the public square, and they spoke accordingly. With the French language and culture and religion appearing secure within Cartier's vision of a Quebec homeland for French Canadians, there was little for French Canadian bishops to add. When denominational education was threatened, Connolly, Lynch, and Horan made their presence felt, both behind the scenes and in negotiating with politicians at the edges of the corridors of power at Westminster. When potential Fenian incursions threatened to marginalize Catholics as disloyal, bishops stepped into the breach to defend the principle of Catholic loyalty that had been established as early as 1760. The actions of the bishops of the 1860s are made sensible when we as scholars are prepared to see them as 19th century bishops and allow for them to play the role they understood to be their primary responsibility under a Protestant crown. After Confederation and the shift of political focus from Westminster to Ottawa, the bishops' role would be recast, new liberties would be exercised by them in the public square. But that is a larger story for another time. Thank you.
You've been listening to a recording of Mark McGowan's talk, Uncomfortable Pews, British North America's Religious Groups Ponder Confederation. The talk was delivered as part of the Other 60s, a decade that shaped Canada and the world. A symposium hosted by the Department of History at the University of Toronto. The talk was delivered on April 22nd, 2017. You can find recordings of other talks at activehistory.ca and be sure to subscribe to the History Chats podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts.